Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Go.
Don't matter. We don't have to go anyway. Come on. Okay, she's gonna burn you.
They ain't gonna catch me now.
All they think about is cars. They're not for you.
They're just a bunch of small town car freaks. That's all they are. They've been following me clear across two states. Three states.
Sure we'll race. You're damn right we'll race.
Pink.
Pink slips? You mean for cars? Where to?
You name it.
Washington, D.C.
After D.C., we'll go on down to Florida. I've got some nice beaches down there.
Just color me gone, baby!
We gotta get some action soon. We'll need Fred to do a little work on the carburetors and check out the rear end.
I want air conditioning.
I want air conditioning, huh?
Automatic heat.
I want automatic heat, huh?
We'll go way better.
We'll roll way better.
In my backseat.
In my backseat.
I don't like being crowded by a couple of punk road hogs clear across two states. If I wanted to bother, I could suck you right up my tailpipe.
Now, this man's dangerous, officer. He passed us on the right a couple of miles back. I swear he's going about 90. He must be on something.
Take it easy, man. You're gonna kill us.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. I've found myself sitting behind the wheel of a large automobile. Sitting shotgun is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Well, you know, they don't make these Detroit machines like this anymore.
This week we're talking about Two-Lane Blacktop, the 1971 film from director Monty Hellman. Something of an existential road movie, the film tells the tale of the driver, played by James Taylor, and the mechanic, played by Dennis Wilson. The two engage in a cross-country road race, kind of slow-moving cross-country road race, with GTO, that's his car and his character name, and he's played by Warren Oates, and the men are joined by Laurie Bird as the girl. So yeah, it's no Cannonball Run, but Two-Lane Blacktop, kind of an interesting road movie. Rob, what's your history and feelings on the film?
Well, I have to tell you, it was a while before I saw this movie, and I think part of the reason why I didn't watch it sooner is because I'm not big fans of one of the guys who's in its music. I'm not a big James Taylor fan. And was just sort of like, do I really want to see him act? But I saw it probably 10 years ago. This is, you know, back when I was in high school, I was watching everything and sort of really avoided it for a long time. And the thing that I find interesting, and we'll get into this a little bit, is the fact that it's 1971. So it's a couple of years after Easy Rider, and it's the exact same year that Vanishing Point comes out. We had talked about Vanishing Point earlier in the year, or late last year on the podcast. You can go back through the archives and find that one. And there's a lot of similarities between all three of those films, between Easy Rider, Vanishing Point, and Two-Lane Blacktop.
I can really see the Easy Rider as far as the characters don't necessarily talk to one another. They're just kind of comfortable with one another, so they don't have to have all these conversations. And I guess that's kind of the same way Kowalski was very quiet, because he didn't have anybody to talk to. The only person who was really talking to him was Super Soul, the DJ. They are very quiet, and they use the road as this kind of meditative device. I can really definitely see a lot of the similarities between the films.
I would say, though, between Two Lane Blacktop and Easy Rider, there seems to be more of a connection than with Vanishing Point. To me, Vanishing Point is very aggressive, which is one thing that this film is not in terms of what you're talking about, this race. It's a race that really doesn't really go too far, and I'll get into my theories on what that's all about after we get into the plot.
This was really tough to see for a long darn time. They showed it one night on like A&E forever ago. Somebody recorded it, and then it was available via the bootleg circuit for a little bit. I believe Video Search in Miami had this one. So you got the little A&E logo in the corner, and some of the dialogue was censored, and you know, you could see the fade outs for TV, that kind of stuff. But tough to find. And one of the reasons was because the problems they had with the music rights. They used the Doors in this, a little bit of Moonlight Drive. And apparently the Doors weren't happy about that later on or something. I don't really know why. I mean, it fits with the movie and it's very quiet. I mean, the use of music in this film is interesting in that it's always like in the background on the radio. It's not like you get this kind of like the score comes up and like, hey, let's rock and roll. You know, there's, speaking of Easy Rider, there's no like Steppenwolf moment where it's like, yeah, we're going down the road and we got this music pumping. It's just like hanging out in the back, hearing it on the jukebox someplace, hearing it on somebody's radio, hearing it in the distance, you know, Laurie Bird kind of singing a couple songs, nothing really in your face.
Well, I also think that in a way that kind of echoes the entire idea of the film. I mean, to me, the film is not really in your face. It's more of a meditation than it is really a plot-heavy, plot-driven, A, B, C, D, got to get there kind of story.
It starts off where you think it's going to, you know, be these guys and they're racing all the time and maybe trying to win some money, that kind of stuff. And then it really kind of quickly turns into this more like these two guys and then they're joined by the girl just driving. And then you get this B story for a little while of GTO and him picking up hitchhikers, and he has this constant patter. And it's almost nice when he comes on the screen compared to like Taylor and Wilson, because those guys just really don't talk to one another. Whereas GTO, it's just this constant stream of pretty much just bullshit the entire time. I love whenever he's there. He's just got this great like presence on screen.
Oh yeah, Warren Oates is great in this. I mean, to me, if it wasn't for Warren Oates, I don't know if it would be watchable for me, because I don't want to spend that much time with Taylor and Wilson. They're not very interesting. But the thing that's interesting about Warren Oates' character, as you were saying, he's just constantly talking all the time, and his story keeps changing. You know, he talks about being a test pilot, and his wife's pregnant, and he's a TV producer, and he's a film scout, and he's a Korean War vet, and it's like his story just keeps on changing. And what I find interesting in the interactions between GTO and also the driver and the mechanic, Taylor and Wilson's character, is that they basically represent like two different eras. Go back, and we've talked about this with First Blood, where the original concept in David Morrell's First Blood was that the sheriff, Teasel, was Korean War vet, and that Rambo was the Vietnam War vet, and they didn't understand each other. And I kind of get the feeling that maybe Warren Oates represents the older generation, possibly Korean War vet, and that Taylor and Wilson could be Vietnam vets, but I don't get the feeling that they were. I get the feeling that maybe they were just sort of hippies or whatever. But they're definitely informed by the Vietnam era, which this movie comes out in 71. So there's a little bit of a tension between them. It's sort of like, okay, Dad, you know, kind of thing, especially when that gas station scene.
Yeah, and there's no real understanding between them. I mean, it's funny how Warren Oates is constantly like trying to learn from them and imitate them, so much so that at the end, one of his stories that he tells, he's basically retelling their whole race and everything. But of course, he makes himself the victor and talking about how, you know, the GTO really isn't that great of a car, but, you know, it's what he won in the race.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's also the aspect of him sort of, especially when he has that conversation, sort of going, you know, I'm the underdog. You know, like, I have this car, it's not very good, but I can still win because it's me.
I'm a driver. I'm a winner. Things are going to change. I can feel it.
Yeah, he's so full of himself. I love it. But yet, he's so full of himself, but at the same time, you can tell that he's very unsure and just kind of, you know, using this blowhard dialogue to cover himself up a little bit.
See, and that's the thing that's really interesting to me in this movie is we don't really understand the characters in a lot of ways. And I don't want to say it's necessarily a negative. I think it's just the way that the story is built in that the driver and the mechanic, we don't really get to know that well except through their actions. We have no real idea of their past or what they're really trying to do. And then Warren Oates is the exact opposite in terms of being GTO, just constantly talks and he's telling you all these things, but you have no idea as to if any of that is actual fact. And so by him telling you all this stuff and them not telling you anything, you're sort of in the same spot. Either you have too much information that's total nonsense or you have no information at all.
Yeah, sometimes it is refreshing that it's not like, oh, well, let me tell you all about myself. Like in a normal movie, Laurie Bird would come in and she would be the new character and then Wilson and Taylor would explain everything to her. You know, and you get a little bit of that, like a real tiny fraction, but it's not like, well, we met when we were 10 and we had this and that and we bought this car and da da da. You know, you don't get that in this film.
Within the context of modern filmmaking, I guess, she would be the audience character. She would come in and ask all the questions that the audience wants answered, and then they would, you know, of course, spill their guts to them because it would just be ridiculous. You know, they don't do Shakespeare, you know, soliloquies in films.
Though maybe they should sometimes.
I could see, you know, James Taylor just, you know, behind the wheel and he just starts spouting off some, you know, long rambly monologue and, you know, iambic pentameter.
You said that you shied away from this movie because of James Taylor as a singer-songwriter. What did you think of his performance?
I thought he was great. I mean, I think that all the leads in here are exceptional, and it was quite a revelation to see him and Dennis Wilson do such a great job. It actually kind of makes me sad that I've, you know, I don't think he's done anything else, or I haven't seen him in anything else. So it, I think it would be interesting. I mean, it obviously shows that he had some sort of understanding of being on film. It's either that or, you know, Monty Hellman's really good at putting the camera in certain places.
Taylor did an amazing job when he was on The Simpsons. That was probably one of my favorite voice cameos ever.
I don't remember that.
Oh, that was when Homer was an astronaut and James Taylor was down at ground control and was singing to them as things were going horribly wrong in the spaceship.
With all due respect, Mr. Taylor, this isn't the best time for your unique brand of bittersweet folk rock.
Listen, Aldrin, I'm not as laid back as people think. Now here's the deal. I'm going to play, and you're going to float there and like it.
There's hours of time on the telephone line talking about things to come. Sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Sweet dreams and flying machines flying safely through the air.
Sort of like, you know, any movies featuring airplane crashes will not be shown on airplanes.
Exactly. And then, yeah, Wilson was great, and I love how natural he is. There are times in the movie where it feels like he doesn't even know that, you know, that a take is happening, where he's just kind of like there watching stuff while it's going on. And as like we would be if we were standing around on the set.
You know, the thing that's interesting is we talk about a comparison between Easy Rider and this to some extent. And with Easy Rider, you get kind of the idea that Fonda's character is more level and that, you know, Hopper's character is a little wild, you know, mm-hmm. The crazy one. In this, you got like two guys who are centered. They're like Zen masters or something. They're just very calm. You don't really see them get upset. They're, you know, one's never like, you know, spastic like how like Hopper is at times in Easy Rider. And I think that's part of why it's so kind of mellow. It's so kind of sedate at times, is that there is no sort of like, you know, coked up Dennis Hopper character.
Really, the names of the characters are what they do and also what they want to do. It seems like the Dennis Wilson character is happiest when he's, you know, making adjustments to the car and trying to make it the best machine that he possibly can.
The film really doesn't have a like we talked about, like an ABCD narrative. I mean, to me, it's more of an idea film, and it's not so much even about the characters at times, because as I said, you know, they don't really feel kind of fully developed in the classical sense, or even the sense of what we see movies today. But to me, it seems more like a life metaphor, you know, sort of like you're in this race, but they don't really seem all that excited about finishing the race. It's just sort of, you know, we'll get there when we get there. And that sometimes you have a partner with you, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you pick people up along the way, sometimes you don't by yourself. And it just sort of seems that the only thing that makes them happy is just staying true to their passions. So it's more like a philosophical idea film than it is really a traditional narrative.
I love road movies, and I love cross-country race movies especially. It almost always seems to me that when you get one of these cross-country races that they're going west. You know, it's that whole go west, young man kind of thing. This is one of the few race movies I can think of where they're headed east. So it's almost like this film is inherently going against the grain. You know, I think about like Death Race 2000, Gumball Rally, Cannonball, Cannonball Run, Cannonball Run 2, all these kind of films. And I want to say almost all of them are either cross-country, you know, from New York over, or in the case of the Vanishing Point, it's what, Denver to California, but it's always going west.
You know, it is sort of going against the grain, I guess, in that way. And just sort of the various, like, ghost town aspects when they do that. I mean, they're going, you know, back east, and they go through some places that are just like deserted. There's like nothing there.
Bringing up the Easy Rider thing again, I mean, that's one of the other few films that I can think of where they are headed east, because I want to say that they end up in Mardi Gras and they've come from California, but again, they're going to Mardi Gras. But again, the South has something to do with this as well, you know, kind of visiting the old country and going through this part of the country where these guys may not be welcome. You know, there's the one line where it's like, you boys aren't hippies, are you?
No, sir. I take care of these boys myself. They're hometown boys. John is married to Mary over there, and Davis is his brother. We're a big family, but we know how to keep it together, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's funny, because there is that diner scene, which sort of echoes the Easy Rider diner scene, but I would say that this one is less menacing. Like, in Easy Rider, you get the feeling that these locals in the diner would kill them in a moment's notice.
And again, with the parallels, I can see the Jack Nicholson character. He's kind of a straight character. Kind of along the lines of GTO. You know, GTO is the one that kind of pulls their fat out of the fire in that scene. And Nicholson is, you know, very in tune with what's going on because he is a Southerner. And, you know, he kind of represents the quote unquote normal world as opposed to these two hippies that he's hanging out with. I guess the biggest difference between the films is the appearance of Laurie Bird and having her along to kind of have this. It's weird because there's like a little bit of sexual tension, but not a whole lot. And it's more like, you know, they pass her around almost.
Well, it's not only that, but we get the feeling also with this situation that they're so sort of absorbed into their own minds and their own heads and what they're doing, that some of these things that come through, be it Laurie Bird or whatever, they're so involved in their work that they can't even really think about that aspect of themselves.
They're not out to say anything or make a statement or, you know, really provoke anybody with, you know, their dress or anything. They just kind of want to do their thing. They want to race their car, maybe make a little bread and just go on to the next one.
Which to me just sort of seems to be about life in general. Matter of fact, there's a line in there, and I can't remember who says it, but there's something about, you know, what does it matter? I mean, we get 30 to 40 years. And that's it. Even they understand that, you know, life is a limited game and that we only get so much. And it really doesn't matter what you do as long as you sort of stay true to whatever it is that fires your passion, I guess. The people that Warren Oates' character picks up from time to time is really interesting and sort of funny at times. He's got this Texan that he picks up and tries to talk big to him. He's got this grandmother and little girl that he picks up and takes them, I believe, to a cemetery. And then there's also one of the hitchhikers is Harry Dean Stanton, which was at first I was like, hey, Harry Dean Stanton. And I was like, oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah, it was great to see him in that as the gay Oklahoman. The scene with the old lady is probably, to me, one of the most poignant scenes in the film. And it just kind of takes you by surprise, I guess, because of where it is in the narrative. You know, it's so close to the end. And it just really, you don't expect her to say what she has to say, you know, and talk about the dangers of life and everything. And just it really, I like the dichotomy too of her with the little girl and just kind of like this generational thing that we see there.
You know, all of those can all be read on some sort of symbolic level, I guess, if you want, in terms of, you know, who we invite into our world, and the car being the world in many ways. Like we've talked about also in Vanishing Point on that episode, that the car sort of represents the entire universe for this character. I think it's sort of the same thing with these people.
I want to say that they treat the gay hitchhiker a little bit better in this one than they did in Vanishing Point, because in that one it felt like it was kind of more making fun of gay people. In this one, Harry Dean Stanton doesn't kind of get the love that he wants, but at least he gets his time in the sun. Well, not really, because it's a very dark scene. He can barely see him, but he gets his time to talk about him and what he wants a little bit. And I think it's a great performance, even though it's so short. And again, you can hardly see him.
Yeah, and half the time he's shot from either the back or like a quarter of his face. It's like all shot from what appears to be like the back seat of the car.
That does present a lot of technical challenges, and I think that they did a pretty good job with that. And especially having audible dialogue was pretty darn important in this one, too. So I was glad we were able to hear everything. Since they don't talk a lot, I was glad we were able to hear what they had to say when they did talk in the car.
We're going to take a break and play a few messages, along with an interview with the director of Two Lane Blacktop, Monty Hellman.
I know you.
I'm watching you right now.
Not really, or maybe I am. However, I guess you're sat there late at night, probably not wearing much and scratching yourself, scouring some podcast-providing service, desperate to find the one glimmer of hope in a sea of blabbermouth halflings expounding their opinions to nobody. You like B-movies, but which B-movie podcast do you pick? Well, look no further. Bypass the rows and rows of other shiny shows and delve instead into the beautiful and brilliant B-movie Bargain Bin! You know how you know it's good? No, it's not just the beards the hosts have, although that's a definite plus. It's the films, it's the fun. It's the fact that by listening to the show, you can also get a discount at cheesyflix.com. That's right, a full, fantastic, knowledgeable B-movie podcast and actual bargains on B-movies. That's once a month at bmoviebargainbin.com. Two men, two beards, two films, one show, the B-movie Bargain Bin. We can't and won't be better. Come on down today to bmoviebargainbin.com, just off Route 49, next to the store with all the stuffed sheep heads in the window. We're doggy.
Hello, I'm Mugumbo, and I am a potaholic. I have been known to consume 4 or 5 of these underground commentaries a day, salivating for the next episodes. I have tweeted the creators of these shows and offered sexual favors for validation and conversation. I put these hosts high on a pedestal, but for some reason, I can never climax until I listen to the Traumatic Cinematic Show. What is the difference, you ask? The Traumatic Cinematic Show has my own self-defecating voice on it. Nothing gets me off faster than thinking about myself. So when you are sitting around nude, pleasuring yourself to the voices of strangers, check out TraumaticCinematic.com, because we'll give you a reach around. You can also find us on TraumaticCinematic.podomatic.com.
I'm on the internet.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know. It's messed up, right?
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's BOOTH. Visit adamandeve.com today.
I was in Europe working on a picture that never got made, that Mark Damon was going to star in and produce, and I was in Italy for about 3 or 4 months. when I got back, my agent, Mike Medavoy, introduced me to Michael Laughlin, and he offered me actually to direct two movies. One was Tulane Blacktop, and the other was The Christian Licorice Store. I didn't like either script, but I was drawn to the idea of Tulane Blacktop and agreed to do that on the condition that I could find someone to rewrite the script, and that's how we made it.
Yeah, what was the story like when you first got it? This was the Will Corey version, is that right?
The Will Corey version, exactly. Two guys, the only thing similar was the fact that they had a 55 Chevy, and they were street racers. I guess the mechanic was a black guy, and he falls in love with this girl they meet along the way, and he starts dropping his mechanic's rags out the window of the Chevy so that she can follow them in her VW Bug. They meet four college kids in a Chrysler convertible, and they I guess they agree to the cross country race. That I don't even remember. There's no GTO, and the characters are nothing like they are in our movie.
You ended up getting Rudy Wurlitzer to work on this. Had you known him before that?
No, he was suggested by somebody I knew, and I read his novel Nog, and I was impressed by that. I was impressed by the sense of his take on the human condition in the cosmic sense, not so much on the sociological sense. And I just fell in love with that and asked him if he wanted to do it. He read read the script and tell me what you think. He read five pages. He said, I can't read it. And I said, that's okay. All you have to know is it's a cross-country race, and take it from there. And that was it.
I had read that Floyd Mutrix was involved in this. Was that true?
Not at all. I don't know where that story gets, but it could be another IMDb error. They make so many errors, you can't even count them, but I have no idea where that came from. Floyd Mutrix was involved in the Christian Licorice Store, however.
Tell me more about the creation of the GTO character.
I don't know. It just came out of, Rudy started writing, and that's what he came up with. And contrary to the way I normally work, I did not read what he was writing as he went along. He just wrote a draft, and I read that. We did talk before he started writing. I went to New York, and we actually had an idea of the characters before he began writing. I started actually preliminarily casting for the girl in New York while I was meeting with Rudy, and I had, I guess Rudy and I both had a 4-hour audio taped conversation with Laurie Bird, just because we felt that she was a good prototype for the character, never thinking that she would actually be playing the part.
And as for the casting, I mean, you have several musicians in the film, and how did you get the feeling that, I mean, obviously they can do it on stage and, in the studio playing music, but how did you get the feeling that they were going to be able to pull off these roles?
The same way I do with anybody. I don't think that the fact that somebody thinks they want to be an actor necessarily makes them any more capable than anybody else you meet on the street. But I just had meetings with them, and then in the case of James, not because I needed it, but because we needed it to show the studio, we did a screen test on him. But I never read people. I just talk to them, and even today when I'm casting, I don't look at an actor's work. I look at them on a talk show or something, just because I want to get a feeling of who they are.
Yeah, this seems like a weird one for Universal to put out.
Well, Universal wasn't the original studio. They weren't the ones that made the deal and bought the script, the Will Corey script, and made the deal to make the movie originally. It was Cinema Center, CBS Cinema Center, which is a nearby studio. It's it's not quite walking distance, but it's very close to Universal. We developed the picture there. They put us up. We had offices, and we did the casting there. And then, I guess, like at a lot of studios, probably at all studios, they didn't really make the final decision until we were all ready to go, and then somebody read the script and didn't like it and canceled the deal. We were put in turnaround, as they call it, and we had 6 months to set the picture up at another studio and buy them out. So we shopped it everywhere. Every place I went, we would tell them how we planned to do it and what our idea of the cost would be, usually in the neighborhood of, I'll just give you an example. We would go to MGM, and we would say, well, this is what we want to do. And MGM, I had to actually come in with diagrams of, they were nervous about how you'd keep it interesting, if a whole movie took place in a car. And I just came in with a diagram showing there were like 23 camera setups in and around the car. And, I said, well, we can make it for $1.1 million. And they say, no, there's no way you could do it for that. It'd cost $1.4 million and we don't want to do it for that. So then we would take it to Columbia and we would tell them $1.3 million and they would say $1.6 million. Anyway, we finally took it to, we went to Warner Brothers, went everywhere, and we finally took it to Universal, and we went back to $1.1 million, and they say, if you can do it for $900,000, we'll make it. We agreed, and then we came in at $850,000.
How was it working with Taylor and Wilson?
As you know, and as we suggested that you're going to talk about, I've been teaching for the last few years, and what I teach is not how to direct, but how not to direct. The problem is that in film schools, they teach directors to direct. And if you talk to most of the, professional people in the business, they don't. Directors don't. If you're smart enough to hire a good actor, you just leave them alone. You let them do what they do. So it's just the opposite of what kids learn in film school. And they come in and they want to be proactive, and it's the worst thing. Even if you have an actor who can't cut it, the worst thing you can do is try to paste a performance onto them. You've got to, then you just got to bite the bullet, or you hire somebody else. But if you hire the right people, then you just let them, and you don't even have to tell them what it's about, because they're smart and they read the script and they know their feelings about it. Then they become, if they're a good actor, they become a kid and they play act it. They imagine themselves doing those things.
You said you were going from place to place, all these different studios, and a few years before, Easy Rider had been done. And as they were talking to you about, it all takes place in a car, and Easy Rider basically takes place on a bike. How did that kind of play in? Did you go in and say, okay, this is the car film, that's the bike film, see how they did that, how well that worked out?
We never mentioned it, nor if we were aware of it. It was only when somebody would tell us that studios were looking for another Easy Rider. They were trying to figure out what made Easy Rider work. So we did inadvertently and half consciously, half unconsciously, take advantage of that. We were there at the right place, in the right time, whatever. And, certainly if without the success of Easy Rider, we would have had a tough time making this movie, and we would have a hard time making it today.
I know you went on to work again with Laurie Bird and, of course, with Mr. Oates and Mr. Stanton and all this. Why did you not work with Wilson and Taylor again? Was it just opportunity didn't present itself?
They were uniquely qualified for those roles, and I'm not sure that either of them was interested in doing another movie. James certainly wasn't, and, James was on the other side of the country, but Dennis was in California, and we remained friends and hung out socially for a while. But it never occurred to me, and I don't think it occurred to him that we would do another picture,
I had read at one point that you were considering Bruce Dern or Kris Kristofferson for the driver. Is that true?
That's true. I don't know if I was considering Chris. Chris came in and met me regarding playing the part. At one point, because we were put in turnaround and didn't have the picture set up again, Warren became unavailable. When we finally had the deal at Universal, we made an offer to Bruce Dern. Bruce Dern's manager or agent, whoever, was kind of using our offer to try to make another deal for him. I guess it was on The Longest Yard. So they wouldn't give us an answer for a few days, and the offer expired. And then when they came back and said they wanted to do it, we said it was too late because Warren had become available again.
So you were thinking of more of him as the GTO role, not the driver role.
That's right. That was for GTO, yeah. Kris Kristofferson actually came in to meet about playing the driver.
Other than Sam Peckinpah, you probably have worked most with Warren Oates, most amount of films. What was his, your interactions like with him, and, why did he become sort of a go-to guy for you during that period? He was in several of your films.
Well, we liked each other. I think that I felt that he was, this is not something that I thought about consciously, but I guess looking back, that in my psychologically, I felt that he was a kind of alter ego, that he could express my feelings or whatever in a role in a movie. So, you know, we just had a connection. You work with people that you like and that also deliver what you need. They have the qualities that you need for this or that role.
How badly did the ending freak out theater patrons, or did it?
I don't know that it did. It freaked out a couple of projectionists that I know. By the way, yeah, you said that I'd worked with Warren more than any other actor. It's not true. I worked with Jack quite a bit more than I worked with Warren. I did 5 movies with Jack.
Yeah, what was it like working with Jack and working with Warren? I mean, they seem like such different personalities, and you use them together in quite a few films as well.
Jack was literally was my partner. We set up a partnership and started writing together and working together, pretty consistently for a while. Jack actually, even though I was aware of Warren, he was friends with Warren, so he was the one that I had the idea of Warren for the shooting, but Jack was the one who called him up and said, listen, you know, we're doing this movie. So he was the connection to Warren.
The first time I saw Tulane Blacktop, it was on a really pretty bad bootleg tape. Why did it take so long for that one to come out on VHS or DVD?
At the time we made it, when you got the rights to use existing music, as we did, it was expensive, even relatively at that time. It's still expensive, but at that time, when you're making a really low-budget movie, music became a healthy part of the budget. But they didn't envision video. When they got the rights and they made the contracts were for the use of that music in the movie and maybe on television. And that was it. And so if you wanted to make a video, you had to get the rights all over again. And that nobody was interested enough to want to go through that process and pay all that money a second time until finally, I think it was Robert Redford started the ball rolling by wanting them to make a new print of the picture so he could show it at Sundance. Then after they made the print and it started circulating again a little bit, then there was kind of a public petition that was set up, you know, starting at Scarecrow Video in Seattle to get the picture released on video.
How was it when you kind of went back to revisit this? You know, it's been put out on DVD twice, and were all the elements available for you, or what was that like?
The elements in the sense that the finished film's elements were available. The negative was available, and the sound elements, which we redid. The Anchor Bay actually went in and did a, I think it was with Anchor. I'm not sure whether we redid the sound with Anchor Bay or with Criterion, but we went back and did a kind of pseudo stereo effect. We originally had stereo elements in the sense that there was originally a 4-track magnetic print that I guess didn't go much farther than Universal. I think they played it in Westwood for a while or something, someplace. But that print, I don't even know if it still existed by the time that we were doing the video stuff. But we did go in and redo it. We did some separating where we did a kind of a stereo surround track, which I like. You know, sometimes those things are done really well, and you know, even in some music, I have some jazz that was done in the UK that where they took Louis Armstrong and did it in stereo, and a lot of other great jazz men. And if it's done well, it really gives you a feeling of presence and being in the place. And I think that's what happened with the track on Tulane.
Having a Criterion release is a pretty big honor, but being in the National Film Registry now for Tulane Blacktop is even a bigger honor. So can you talk about how that process was, and do they give you a plaque or anything for that?
I don't even know if they've even contacted me in any way, but maybe they did. Maybe I got a letter or something. But No, it's something that, you know, there's the picture developed quite a few fans over the years, particularly after it started coming out on video, and there would be people who would just kind of throw it in the hopper every year when it came to selecting what was going to be brought into the registry, and it would just keep coming up, and it would get closer and closer, and finally, I think it was one of the people at one of the film preservation universities or whatever actually called me and said, John Bailey, who was the assistant cameraman on the movie, was one of the advisors. He called me and said that it was very close, and if it wasn't this year, it would surely be next year, but it turned out to be this year.
So you'd mentioned a little bit about the classes that you're teaching. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I can't remember who it was who called me, over 10 years ago, actually, to see if I was interested in teaching at USC. And I started there for 2 or 3 years teaching a class. And then CalArts came to me and asked me about moving over there. And it was not a difficult decision because they paid quite a bit more. I mean, even though they're out in the Thule's from the standpoint of L.A., it wasn't any longer ride. It took me 30 minutes to drive to SC and takes me 30 minutes to drive to CalArts. So it was an easy decision. I go where the money is. I'm basically a whore. I've always been a whore. I will always continue to be a whore.
But you're so kind to us on the phone, so.
He's a whore with a heart of gold.
Exactly.
Well, to help you line the pocket a little bit more, where can folks learn more and sign up for the classes?
We have a full house. Last time around, I taught 9 students in 2 sessions. So I had 5 on one night and 4 on another. And then I had my son and daughter and some other people that would kind of come around on whichever night they felt like it. But I forget why we divided it, but we decided it would be easier just to do smaller groups and come on, do it on 2 nights. And this time I've got 10 students and we're all going to crowd into my tiny little office on one night a week. And we actually start Tuesday night. So there's only room for 4 chairs. And if there's 10 people, there's not even room for the chairs. So we have to kind of put them on the bed, sitting in front of the bed, and then somebody on a tiny little stool somewhere off in the corner somewhere.
You mentioned your daughter. Is that Melissa?
That's Melissa, one of my stars from Tulane Blacktop.
Yeah. How was it? Was that her first film role?
That was her first film role. That's right. And my son Jared's in it as well. But she continued to have an acting career for a while, and Jared went off to be a computer scientist, software engineer. Now he's come back into the craziness of our family, and he's writing screenplays.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the new film you're working on?
You could easily define it as a romantic spy thriller. However, it's got one extra element. It's supernatural. So it's a supernatural romantic spy thriller.
It sounds like you're in the very nascent stages of that.
Well, it's been going on for a little while, but we're actually getting close to making a deal on financing, at least for partial financing. And you never have what you need right away, but it's that first money that gets the movie made. So we're at that point.
Now, with your last film, Road to Nowhere, if memory serves, did you work with some of your students on that one?
A lot of my students came to North Carolina to work on the picture, and then we also had some students from the University of North Carolina. So there were a lot of students working on that movie.
Between working with students and teaching and that, I was just wondering, you've obviously had a career that's spanned several decades. You've done a lot of different things. What's the one piece of advice you try to impart to your students? You're like, above all else, remember this.
It's advice that most of them don't want to hear, because it's the antithesis of what they believe is the correct way to have a career. And they're right, and I'm wrong. But if you want to really have a happy career, if you want to, do work that pleases you, it's just you know, it's the oldest advice in the world. It's to thine own self be true. Thou canst not then be false to any man. It's just, if you do movies that you love, not because you think somebody else is going to like them, you'll never have any regrets. If you make a movie that you think is going to please the world and it doesn't please anybody, and not even you, then you have a lot of regrets.
Back. Thanks again to Mr. Hellman for talking to us. To hear more from Mr. Hellman, check out the episode we did way back when we talked about his film Flight to Fury. He was also a special guest on a Reservoir Dogs episode earlier this year. Now, we asked Mondi about the involvement of Floyd Mutrix with the project, and he didn't seem to think that Floyd was involved at all, despite him being listed on the IMDb. Now, I know better than to trust the IMDb when it comes to being accurate in any way, shape, or form, but I just wanted to find out what was going on, so I gave Floyd a call. I'd play back the interview with Floyd, but he wanted to remain kind of off the record, saying that it was 40 years ago, and he wouldn't swear to most of the things that he said, but he was certain that he was involved with the project early on, before Hellman even, back when the screenplay was just written by Will Corey. And he remembered Hellman getting involved, getting on board with the project, and even talked a little bit about the book Nog by Rudy Wurlitzer that impressed Hellman so much. So there were actually three films going on at once at the offices that he and Hellman worked out at the same time. It was Two Lane Blacktop, Dusty and Sweets McGee, and Christian Liquor Store. And Floyd wrote, and I think he directed, two of those. And Hellman even had a small role in Christian Liquor Store, which took me years to track down, but I finally did. So a few of the things that he told me included him casting the role of James Taylor as the driver, saying that he was really impressed with Taylor and he, quote, wanted that badass from the cover of Sweet Baby James. And he also talked about Floyd, that he was a real gearhead and he helped with the making of the Chevy for the movie. And he talked about going out on Van Nuys Boulevard and what a bitchin' ride it was. He said that he did two things for the movie. He got James Taylor and he got the car, and one of them was the right thing to do because he didn't really think that James Taylor was the best actor for it. So he was really disappointed that James Taylor didn't even know how to drive a stick. So he said that there were two cars that were for the movie. One was the manual that they used for the racing, and one was an automatic that they used for the shooting, which had air conditioning and was, you know, nice for those guys when they were doing that. And then the one thing that he told me that I had never heard before was that the car actually managed to get another role after Two Lane Blacktop in another film produced by Gary Kurtz, who produced this. It's the car that Bob Falfa drives at the end of American Graffiti, and I had never heard that one before.
Hey, I like the color of your car there, man. What's that supposed to be? Sort of a cross between piss yellow and puke green, ain't it?
Well, you call that a paint job, but it's pretty ugly. I bet you got to sneak up on the pumps just to get a little air in your tires.
He said that the original Will Corey script was kind of more, kind of get it at the beginning of the film, where you get the driver and the mechanic, and they're kind of, you know, making bets with people and doing that whole thing. That he said that the original script was much more of these two guys kind of going around and almost like scamming people and trying to get people interested in races and making money that way. So one of these days we're going to talk to Floyd again, and this time we can hopefully get it on the record when we talk about Dick Tracy, because that was his baby for a while. And if you want to hear more from Floyd Mutrix, you can go over and listen to our old episode on The Adventures of Ford Fairlane, and you can grab that from our archives over at projection-booth.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, how you like that for a long-winded thing?
Hey, well, you know, you do what you got to do. At the same time, you know, it's interesting that he was able to pull some of this stuff up.
Yeah, Floyd just kept saying, what do you want from me? It's 40 years ago. I'm like, yeah, I know it's 40 years ago. This came out the year before I was born. I didn't say that to his face, though, or to him on the phone.
because that's when the folks who are now collecting Social Security slam the phone down on you and refuse to take your calls anymore.
But it's funny, a lot of the stuff that he said, like, kind of directly contradicts, you know, some of the stuff, like, on the, like, in the Blu-ray packaging. I tried to watch the Blu-ray this morning, finally, busted. It doesn't work at all. I don't know if it's one of those, like, Criterion specials where it was a bad burn or something, but I'm going to have to send this thing back. I'm so pissed.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The Criterion folks are super cool about taking returns, because I had a problem with a Videodrome disc, and they sent me a whole new package, so that was cool.
I'll have to find out where I can send this, because, yeah, I was so mad that I put it in and, like, nothing that I had would recognize the disc at all. It's like, oh, great. But anyway, I dug out the booklet, and yeah, and they write in the booklet, the casting of James Taylor was Hellman's brainchild. Quote, I saw a billboard on Sunset Boulevard and I just flipped over his face. James came out and did a screen test and he had a mustache. We weren't sure whether we wanted him with or without it. So on the screen test, he shaves it off. So I wanted to see if that screen test was on the DVD, because they finally found him on the old Anchor Bay. They talk about him and they, you know, said, oh, those are lost forever. But
it's nice that you've worked your way into the world of Blu-ray, sir.
I still don't have a Blu-ray player per se, but I do have one on my computer. So that's the only way I watch. I've got the little tiny screen and the Blu-ray player, and I just watch them that way.
It's the most high-def small screen you'll ever see.
All those lines of resolution, baby.
50 watts per channel, baby kicks.
180, 181, whatever it takes.
On a 15-inch screen. Anyway, when we talk about Tulane Blacktop, we did compare it a little bit to some of the other films. And I thought it was interesting that, you know, the ones that obviously come up in our head are of the era. It is Vanishing Point. It is Easy Rider. But there was also another one I wanted to talk about, because with a movie like this, I don't think you can make films like this in the studios anymore. This is definitely a product of its day. But the closest within the last few years, although it does have more of a straightforward narrative, is, I would have to say, would be, and ironically enough, he's called The Driver, is Drive.
How do you see them kind of comparing? I mean, is it the quietness of the character or his relationships? How are you seeing that?
Well, I see Drive as kind of maybe fits in the middle ground between both Vanishing Point and Tulane. I mean, Vanishing Point, because it is so, Drive is aggressive, unlike Tulane, which is a little more laid back. But I would say that it is more about, we don't really know so much about this person. We kind of fill it in based on their actions. They're very quiet. When someone explained Drive to me before I saw it, I go, that kind of sounds more like Fistful of Dollars or something. You know, it sounds like one of the Clint Eastwood quiet westerns where you don't really know about him. He kind of shows up in town, he does the job, and that's it. So I just think that from the aspect of, once again, it being sort of a kind of a road movie or car obsession film, and then also that the character is very much focused in on the work, and it's not so much about ABCD, although there is a little bit more of a narrative in Drive.
Yeah, when I saw Drive, it really reminded me of The Driver, Walter Hill's film, and I've also wanted to kind of do a double feature of those two. Okay, stay with me now, because my mind's going to wander. The thing I really liked about The Driver was Bruce Dern, and it really felt a lot like when I was watching Tulane Blacktop, that Bruce Dern really could have done an interesting take on the GTO character. And I guess the two reminded me of each other, Bruce Dern and Warren Oates in this one, just because he's constantly saying, you know what I mean? And that was like the great line in The Laughing Policeman, when Bruce Dern would say these horrible things and just kind of always pepper, you know what I mean, into there. So I wonder how Bruce Dern would have done his GTO. But really, you know, we talked about Warren Oates in our Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia review. And he really is just, I've never seen a bad Warren Oates performance.
I've seen a bad Quaker Oates performance, but not a bad Warren Oates performance.
I've seen Warren Oates in some bad movies, but he's always been good in them.
Like you were saying with Bruce Dern, it would have added a different level because, I mean, the fact that Warren Oates is older sort of plays in that tension. If you would have had Bruce Dern, he would have been almost the same age as them at that point. And it would have been much more like just rivals of the same age as opposed to it being generational.
You know, one of the things that I like about Hellman, you know, you talked before about his direction of Wilson and Taylor was that when it comes to his editing, and he usually edits his own films, is that he usually edits more for performance than for action, rather than worrying about, you know, that typical Hollywood editing where it's like, you know, the guy puts a cigarette up to his lips, cut to the close-up of him putting the cigarette, you know, and it's all one fluid movement, that he's more about, like, what is the guy saying, what is the guy doing as he's, you know, doing his stuff, and he doesn't really care about those, like, the details of the action. It's more of the performance of the character. And I think that that really plays a big part in this film is that, you know, we cut around the performances rather than around the story.
That almost kind of reminds me of maybe something that you would have learned or he would have learned from all the French New Wave films, you know, because, you know, I mean, it's not jump cutty by any means, but Godard and them were much more about the performance piece than they were about, oh, well, you know, the cigarette was this long and now it's this short and now it's long again.
And that always drives me crazy when people are just, you know, so nitpicky about those kind of little things. It's like the major ones, you know, somebody's outfit changing from one cut to another or whatever. It's like, yeah, maybe that should be pointed out and might have been fixed somehow, but really, if you can stay with the story, if the editing doesn't take you out of the story, do it however you need to. I want a story. I don't necessarily want 100% technical capability.
That was the comment that we made back at this, once again, reference to the First Blood episode with Flooding with Love for the Kid, where it's like, give it 10 minutes, you realize what he's doing, he's shooting it all in his apartment, but the story's so good and the performance is so good, it doesn't matter that, you know, he's standing next to the refrigerator.
Right. Exactly. Do you have anything more, sir?
No, I just want to know, are you guys the Zodiac Killers?
I'm still on the fence as far as Laurie Bird being an actress. You know, it's like, I don't know what it is, but it's like every performance I've seen her in, and I only really remember two, it's this one and Cockfighter. I guess it's because her characters are usually so annoying that I always wonder if she was that annoying in real life.
Kind of goes back to, I remember when I was in high school, I had an English teacher who was like, Juliette Lewis, that's not acting. He felt she was a little crazy. So maybe it's the same thing. Laurie Bird, she's that annoying. I don't know. Never met the lady. She's probably very nice.
Well, you're not about to meet her. So she committed suicide a few years ago.
Ah, okay. Well, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, threw herself out a window. One of the few times you get to use the word defenestration.
Defenestration?
It means to throw oneself out a window.
That's a fancy word. That's the $5 word of the episode.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after a preview from next week's show.
Night by the fireplace. We just finished with our chauffeur, and now I'll talk about him, father, and the old days. It was more difficult than I had imagined. Mother had made everything sound easy, but the chauffeur was incredibly strong. He had to be stabbed 5 times. In the end, he ran screaming with a knife in his belly and splattered blood all over our house. When we buried him, he was still alive.
That little whore. Cette petite pute, I'm talking about that bitch daughter of mine. She thinks I have no idea of what happened. Well, I heard it all, and tomorrow we'll have it out.
What are you
trying to do it, force a confession out of me.
Who are you covering up for?
No one. You're trying to protect someone.
Remember, we buried Laura together. Your father was there too.
Leave my father out of this. I didn't bury anyone. Why are you doing this in front of him? You ruined everything.
You'd better tell the truth.
What difference does it make what I say? You've made up your mind I'm guilty. You know I didn't kill anyone.
Then why did you tell me the radio at the lake house was broken?
Because do I have to have those lights in my face? Why are you doing this? You ruined everything. I said I'll make him talk.
Don't you realize you're involved in a murder? Don't expect help from anyone. That one is already dead.
But I promised. I'll make him talk by tomorrow night.
All right. You have just over 24 hours before you fail.
That's right, we're back next week. The episode, Singapore Sling. No, we're not talking about the drink. We're talking about a Greek detective and debauchery film. And believe me, you're going to like this one. We'll be joined by our resident expert in all things debauched, Fraulein Von B. Of course, go back to the solo episode if you want to hear her golden tones and her talking with us. I don't know what it is, Mike, but it's like this episode has so many references to other episodes. It's like people are like, stop pimping your old material, will you?
This is like one of those Nexus episodes where all things come together.
Speaking of all things coming together, that'll be Singapore Sling next week. I want to thank this week's special guest, Mr. Monty Hellman, of course, Floyd Mutrix, who you didn't hear his voice, but Mike told you what he said. And also want to thank everyone out there for listening. Of course, thank you in return for heading over to iTunes and giving us some reviews or, you know, writing your comments at projection-booth.com. And, you know, it's just about one more thing that we're trying to do in our effort at world domination.
And don't forget the time's running out over on our VHS Extravaganza episode. You still have time to call in and leave us your memories of renting movies, or maybe you worked at a video store. It was a place for fond memories, I'm sure. So give us a call over at 666-0800 and leave us a voicemail.
That's 734-666-0800.
Yes, it is.
That's right, 734-666-0800. And we want you to be part of the show, so leave that voicemail now. And not only that, but you'll be a star when you do, believe it.
watching my TV and a man come on to tell me how white my shirts can be, but it can't be a man 'cause it doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me.
Danger is if they send us to that terrible planet of the apes. Wait a minute, Statue of Liberty. That was our planet! You maniacs! You